Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
This is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm really good, as always.
As always?
Yeah, because I just feel like, when would I ever say, really bad today?
When you had meningitis, which you kept banging on about.
He brought that one up already.
Your
agent in LA is going to love that one.
No, Margate is fed up of hearing about.
Oh, Margate is fed up of hearing about.
Enough with Margate.
No more to the double M, because apparently every single M&M's. Person I meet, Russell walks up to them after I've met them for like 5 minutes.
Do you know he had meningitis? Do you know he's got a place in Margate?
And they're like, yeah, we've heard.
You're obsessed. Yeah. So who's our guest today, Rob?
Our guest today, I met in the Balearic Islands about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, the dog's Balearics.
It was summertime. It was like a beautiful breeze. And the funny thing was, we were going for lunch in.
Was it a date?
No, it wasn't a date. He's very straight. There was a date. There was a beautiful view.
Yeah,
and I remember sitting at this lunch, and we were expecting this person to arrive with a big group of people. And we thought it was Jamie Beauchere, who is a really well known kind of supermodel icon, Marc Jacobs, like. Photographed her a lot for when he was at Louis Vuitton. Right. She's incredible. I love her.
Okay.
So we thought this Jamie was coming, and we were like, oh, Jamie's coming for lunch with all our friends, la la la. And then suddenly this group turned up, and it wasn't Jamie Beauchere.
It was
Boy Jamie. So he became known to us as Jamie Boy, and Jamie Girl was still in Ibiza. And so he is a photographer, and I actually did know his work before I met him and had seen his advertisement campaigns for Loewe, which J.W. Anderson had commissioned at the time when he first took over the kind of creative direction of the brand. And I was blown away by these photographs because, for me, they looked like art. They were artworks in a way, but in fashion magazines. And it really struck me at the time, his use of light and atmosphere and a kind of sensuality that was different. And I hadn't really seen it in contemporary magazines. So it was really exciting at the time. So when I actually heard his name, and Jamie Boy, I heard his surname, I was so excited because I actually really respected what he'd done. And I'd literally been talking to Carmen March, who I was with on holiday, about his photography like the week before, and had no idea I was about to meet him. So it was quite a nice synchronicity moment. So we would like to welcome Jamie Hawksworth.
Thanks, guys.
How are you, Jamie?
Very good. Thanks for the kind intro.
That's all right.
Good.
Was that a true intro? Was that a nice...
It's very sweet, yeah, thank you.
I feel like I've always been very, like, fanboy around you.
It was a very nice breeze that day, so...
Oh, it was? I really want to know about this breeze. It's incredible you remembered it.
It's a beautiful spot there.
Why was you in Formentera? Where was it, Formentera?
Yeah, but we shouldn't tell people at Formentera because I don't want anyone else to go there because I love it so much.
Because of the breeze.
I just love it.
God, it's a unique...
I was sort of on a mini holiday.
Oh, nice. You weren't working then?
No, I wasn't working, no. So
okay.
Yeah, and we crossed paths, which was great.
That's nice. So... Rob loves you because Rob's a big fashion boy. I mean, I like fashion, but Rob saw your work through fashion.
Yeah.
But as well as being one of our top fashion photographers, one of our biggest exports, British exports, your work is art. Your work is shown in the public persona. The work is shown in public institutions, and you've had lots of shows all around the world. How did that crossover happen? How did you get into the fashion photography?
I kind of got into photography in a very sort of strange about way. I was actually studying forensic science at university, and I did that for a year. And the course was kind of cut up into two halves. It was half very practical and half very law-based.
Right.
And I failed my law exam. And the one thing that I really loved about the practical side of forensics was they had all these mock crime scene houses up in Preston, and we would like collect evidence and then document the evidence very objectively with photography.
Oh, right.
And that was the very first time I kind of saw photography in kind of a different light, so to speak.
They was all mock- you never went to a real crime scene?
No, they were all like...
They, you weren't allowed.
It was quite. It was still kind of amazing because they basically brought a whole street of houses and each house was a different scene. It was kind of remarkable.
So crazy.
Yeah, it was really great.
Like a film set type thing,
yeah, oh, complete 100%.
Did they have like actors and stuff there?
Yeah, yeah. Then someone was dead and you'd go upstairs and someone would be dead in the bath and... You know, it was kind of, it was...
Did they ever give you a wink or anything? Like,
well, I'm alive.
It was every, Friday mornings at like 8 a.m, you would go into the lab and you would talk through the theory of it all.
Yeah.
And then it'd be like, right, put your gear on and we'll go down the street. And it was kind of as simple as that. And it was amazing because, you know, once you collect the evidence and you're documenting it, I just saw it was just a sort of little light switch went off where it's like, wow, photography can... You know, you can use photography in this way. And then, like I said, I filed the law and I was like, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I spoke to my dad and I said, you know, I think photography would be interesting. And then I switched course and I really did kind of fall in love with it sort of immediately.
Right.
And I kind of really, you know, it just took over my life, I suppose. So
what age was it when you first picked up a camera?
It was 19.
19.
Yeah. And then I studied for 2 years for photography and then I graduated.
What was the first sort of pictures you were taking?
The funny thing was, because I loved it so much that I always felt really guilty when I wasn't taking pictures because I thought, God, I found something I really love doing. I should make the most of it. And the most accessible thing to do was just walk the streets because I didn't really know how to use a studio. I wasn't very technical. So I kept it extremely simple. I remember I was given this medium format camera when I first started. And that's the camera I use now. Mm. And I've kept it extremely simple. And
what does that mean, medium format?
Medium format is like the size of the negative. So you have like a 35mm camera,
yeah,
which people, I guess, are more familiar with.
Yeah.
And then one jump up is a 6.7. And then up there, one jump is like a 5.4 and then a 10.8.
Right. What one did you have to start with?
A 6.7.
6.7.
So funny enough, I skipped 35mm photography. So when I started the course, because I'd missed year one, I was given this medium format camera. They're like, well, there you go. And I
was part of the course.
As part of the course, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I was never, and I wasn't taught 35mm photography, so I sort of skipped a stage, which was kind of funny.
Because, did you have to teach yourself that afterwards?
Yeah, and it was so funny because I was on a photography course and I thought, oh, I'll rent out a 35mm to see how it works. And I had to go into Jessop's to ask how to load the camera. But I could load a medium format camera. So it was kind of a funny little moment.
Mr. Blip, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like I said, the most accessible thing to do was just go out and take people's portraits. Uh-huh. So very quickly, I got into kind of, you know, the sort of exchange you have with a stranger is such an interesting one. And you kind of have to, you sort of put yourself on the line as much as a stranger does. You know, it's very sort of nerve-wracking. So I immediately got into...
Oh, so when you say walking the streets, you're actually approaching people.
Yeah,
Not photographing like a plant or a paving slab.
I did do that. But then, you know, naturally, people started to catch my eye. So then I would like... You know, it's very hard when you first begin to approach strangers because you're like, well, what do I say?
Yeah.
But I very quickly kind of learned how to what the right things were to say. And
I suppose you've got to charm people to feel like they're going to feel safe.
Yeah, because it's such a fleeting relationship. You know, it's like it can last a minute, really.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a strange one. So I started doing that a lot. And that's kind of how I very quickly got into kind of the details of what people would wear and the way that they would look and their body language and, you know, just things that you might kind of miss normally. I've got really, my eye kind of got right in there and I was fascinated with it. So I guess that's kind of where, you know, my fascination with people came. And then later on, I guess that led to...
And their personality through clothing.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't sort of, right at the beginning, I wasn't really consciously thinking the relationship, like you say, between their attitude and their clothing necessarily. It was kind of, it was very naive. It was something would just sort of stick out and I'd run towards it without really even thinking about it.
Right.
And then I started to do the Preston Bus Station project, which is where I really did. It was like a sort of explosion went off in my head, I think, because the very nature of the bus station was it was built like a circle. So I used to circle the circle every day for a month.
So
from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And it was the centre for the megabus also. So you had people from the south of England moving through up to the north and vice versa. So this was incredible space where I could literally walk in circles and photograph people. And
I also thought you were dodgy, right?
Do you know what? I got so many. It was really funny. Like one day, you know, I'd start the day and like 10 minutes in, I'd be called a paedophile. And you know what I mean?
Really?
Yeah, 100%. And it's sort of funny. And I, but the thing, I got permission from the security and they knew that I was there. Mm. So it was sort of, it was fine. But
did you ever do it furtively, take pictures of people? Or did you always, was your thing, you go and ask them and then
exactly.
they post for you?
Yeah, yeah. It was right. all, it was always, I always want, I felt it was so important to have, like I say, that kind of exchange
permission
and the relationship. Because, you know, so much, you know, and this was sort of something I thought a lot afterwards. You know, the way that I am as a person and the way that I talk to people and the way that I look and the way that I use my camera, it really affects the way that a portrait ends up coming out and the way that someone responds to you is so important. So I made that decision very early on that I didn't want to kind of sneak around and take people's pictures. I wanted the exchange and the relationship to form, even if it was like a fleeting one. Like I said.
And you did that for a month?
I did that for a month.
Yeah. And that was in Preston. So you were studying in Preston, weren't you, at the University of Lancashire?
Yeah, UCLan it's called.
Yeah. And you were part of this collective called Preston Is My Paris.
Yeah. So Adam Murray and Robert Patterson, who Adam taught me photography.
Right.
And they made a little zine, like you say, Preston Is My Paris, which was, it was really amazing. It was all sorts of things, but you know, it was sort of everything from sort of found objects to interviews to people that were working up in Preston or making art. And then Adam asked me to come for a weekend to make a newspaper about the bus station. So that was the very first thing.
And how old were you then?
I just graduated, so I would have been 21.
Okay.
Preston Is My Paris is such an amazing title.
It's for perfect.
Like saying, celebrate your local place and make that your culture inspiration.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of that. Like, I'm from Billericay. I'm saying Billericay is my Berlin, but it's got the same sort of, it hasn't got the same sort of ring.
It's got a ring, though.
It's got a slight ring.
I like that.
Yeah.
And last year, you published a book. Well, you didn't, but Dashwood Books published a book.
Yeah.
Who are an amazing store in New York.
Yeah.
And a publisher who I love.
Yeah, David's great.
Yeah, really great. But, Of all those photographs, so even though what year were they taken? 2000.
So in 2009, I think, when I graduated, I went back for 2 days, and Adam at the time was doing kind of black and white architectural pictures, and his friend Robert was doing like sort of details on Polaroid, and we also had this architect write a piece for the newspaper, and it was a very simple. There was four portraits that I did, and Adam's and Robert's pictures, and we created like I think 500 newspapers. And then left them in the bus station so people could pick them up and take them home.
Oh, nice.
Or chuck them in the bin or whatever it may be. And then 2 years later, the bus station was going to be demolished.
Oh.
So I had this kind of heart attack where I was like, God, it was so great to be in there for that weekend. And I thought, you know, the bus station's never going to disappear. I'll go back another day and maybe take some more.
Yeah.
But then when I heard that news, I was like, fuck, I've got to move back to Preston and spend every day there for as long as it takes. Before it gets demolished. So that's exactly what I did.
Has it gone now?
I didn't know
that. And then it got saved. There was this huge petition, and it's an incredible brutalist building.
Yeah. So it's listed now.
Yeah, it's listed.
Oh, fantastic.
So but also your book has become a kind of like a part of that, I guess, hasn't it? Like,
well, it was funny because I
documented that space.
I had this sort of weird dream where I had an exhibition in the space and I put all the pictures up on the walls. And weirdly, a little part of me loved the idea that when the bus station would be demolished, my photos would sort of crumble away with it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Kind of this sort of romantic idea of destruction and whatever.
Right.
But then, obviously, I was extremely happy that it didn't get demolished.
Are they still up?
Yeah, well,
they're permanent.
Yeah, there's one that's still up, but it's like vinyl. So they sort of peeled a lot off.
Right.
But there's like one right in like the top left hand corner of like a boy leaning on his hand.
Oh wow!
I guess they can't be bothered to kind of get a ladder.
But do you ever see them like the models for these? Were they just that photo and you've never seen them since?
No. So when I did the show in there, there was a few of them that came.
Oh really?
And there's a picture of a woman with she's waiting for the bus and she has a really small watch on and a leather bag. And she has this kind of amazing haircut. She must be about 60 years old. And she came with her daughter. And she was massive. Like, I blew up. It's one of my favourite pictures. So I blew up huge. And she couldn't quite believe that, you know, something as simple as waiting for a bus. And then 2 years later, she's kind of blown up massive.
Did she like the picture?
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
Do you name them after your sitters? Or did you name the photos after?
No, I don't really name them, actually. I've never really named them. I kind of just say Preston Bus Station and then the date. Because I guess, actually, it's kind of true to how it was in the moment, because a lot of people, you know, they'd say yes to having their portrait, but they didn't really want to say much more.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of waiting for the bus and getting on with their day. And, you know, luckily they let me creep into their life for like a second, but then that was kind of it. So it's sort of nice that I like the pictures that they kind of stay true to that, so you don't really get people's names, because I never did, you know, sort of...
Anonymous, but you just take them for what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And that was your big kind of moment.
That was my very first project, and then I started to show people down here in London the newspaper and some of the photographs, and that's how I kind of then started to... Because once I graduated university, I tried to assist quite a few documentary photographers, and no one really needed assistance. And actually, Adam said, well, you should try fashion photographers because they always need assistance. So that's kind of how I then started to get even, you know, obviously get more into even just being in that environment, because I was assisting fashion photographers. Mm-hmm. So every, you know, during the week I'd assist, and then every single weekend I'd catch a train around England and carry on taking portraits of people. So it was always constantly...
What, like train stations and bus stations?
Yeah, train stations, bus stations, but more so just picking a place, going there, not knowing what I'm going to come across, and then just leave the station and walk around.
What do you think is it about them places that inspires you then?
I think it's sort of the unknowing, I guess. At that point, it was like, well, I don't know this place. I've never been there, so I'm going to go see what it's about.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the uncertainty of it all, and I guess being kind of open to chance is what I found really exciting. And the idea of getting on a train or a bus and going on like a trip felt so exciting to me. And
so you're like an adventurer.
Yeah,
with
kind
a camera.
Yeah, it sounds so cheesy, but it's true. It's kind of like it gives you, I was so fascinated with not knowing what I was going to come across. And I think that actually that's quite hard to be open to sometimes, because I think particularly with anything creative, sometimes the idea of an idea is quite heavy. You can get quite heavy. So I like the sort of the lightness of just going somewhere and then seeing what I came across. And I learned that in the bus station. I know that that was an idea itself, but then being in there, I never knew who I would see. You know, I never knew, because there was people coming in and out, and I never knew what I would see. So I kind of stayed true to that little detail, and then that's informed pretty much all of my work since, really.
What is a successful portrait to you?
It's a good question. Like I say, I think it is... it's important that there is an exchange between you and the person that you're photographing, and that almost your point of view on that person sort of dissipates, and then it becomes like this sort of, I don't know, I think with a good portrait there's quite a lot of space around it, and you don't really see the photographer, and you kind of just appreciate that person in all their glory, and that's it, I think.
Do you like the conceptual story to get in that portrait? For you, that's personal.
Yeah, well, just the simplicity of a portrait is also fantastic, in that, you know, if I'm just walking the street or I go to a place and I just come across this person and I ask to take their portrait, you know, just the simplicity in that is such a wonderful thing, because, you know, it's a stranger, and then suddenly you have this relationship for a minute, and then you've created something, and it's sort of, it's fascinating really that can still happen.
They're like historical documents, aren't they? You've captured like a moment, especially when it comes to fashion, when it comes like on street fashion.
I mean,
you really can define a period of time by capturing that.
No, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I've always been really blown away by your use of light. And I think partly because of your experience of, you know, just going out onto the street, and you don't have studio lights and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you obviously learned to take photographs that way.
Yeah.
Somehow you're really good at knowing how to find the right light in a picture. And actually the front cover of the Preston bus stop book has incredible light behind the guy's afro. I mean, it's this incredible,
insane,
beautiful photograph, almost like angelic or something, quite religious.
I couldn't quite believe if you could imagine being in this big circle and sort of coming around the top half of the circle, and this kid being at the bottom end of it, and he was just standing there. He wasn't quite looking like that. He was kind of just doing nothing. And this light was coming, and I kind of ran. I was like, fuck. Like, I couldn't believe my eyes. And it's sort of, again, there's sort of what was great about the bus station was you did have these huge windows, and on one side you had kind of south light that was always had this warm light coming in, and on the other side you had north light, which was very kind of cold and indirect, you know, it was very soft, but not sun. And I very quickly learned that, okay, if I take someone's portrait in north facing light, it's kind of going to look like this,
right?
And if I take them in south facing light, it's going to kind of have this feel. So it was the first place where I could, because actually it's quite hard to look at light, you know, it's everywhere, but you don't really necessarily look at it
exactly.
And what was great about the bus station was that you had these amazing people in there, and I could see how light was affecting them. So I could see light for the first time. You know, once I'd switched from photography, from forensics. I wasn't kind of walking around the street looking at light. I was just looking at the people, so to speak.
And there's definitely a sensitivity that you have and a kind of subtle approach to it somehow, where I can always know when it's your work, which is quite unusual in photography in a way, when it's become so ubiquitous and so everywhere and everyone's taking pictures and are a photographer. Yours still has this very strong language, as do, you know, there's other fashion photographers who I think also operate, you know, outside of fashion somehow, like even Tim Walker, because his shots are so
like
over
Jürgen
the top.
Teller, and, Wolfgang
but even Alastair McClellan, who's in, you know, does fashion shoots, but he, when you see his photos, you know they're his.
Totally.
But yours are very much yours. And I just think that's such a interesting thing. And right now, Edward Enningfull has obviously taken over at Vogue in the last few years and doing an incredible job. And he commissioned you to take a picture of Kate Moss, which is on the front cover of the new issue, I think, isn't it, coming out now?
Yeah.
And that picture, then I saw it come up on Instagram the other day, and I was like, that's a Jamie picture. And I didn't actually know it was you posting it. I'm not, maybe it was him who posted it. I can't remember. But
it was the breeze, wasn't it?
I saw it.
The pictures. you know.
But I just thought that was Kate at her most truthful somehow. It felt like a real portrait of her. And there was something about, a bit like the cover of that book, that just your way of using light or, you know, in the photo.
Well, it was really, I mean, in the context of that, it was incredibly, again, it was so simple. We didn't have any hair and makeup. There wasn't a stylist. She was on holiday in India, and I went by myself.
Did you?
Yeah, and just went to take her essentially take her portrait. And
so
we
you're really cheap for them as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was like a cheap deal.
Yeah.
That's why he asked me. But no, yeah, and so, you know, it's staying as true as I can to the way that I always really enjoy taking pictures in, is there's such a simplicity. And actually, like what you say about recognising photographs, I think that in a kind of natural way, when I first started travelling around England and going to places, it would always be quite cold, and once I got the pictures back, it didn't feel as optimistic as I would like. So I started to warm up the pictures a little bit, because I wanted the pictures to feel very optimistic and celebratory of a place. And naturally, in the darkroom, I kind of started to shift the colours from being a little bit more on the warmer side. And I think, and you know, obviously, you know, your relationship with colour, particularly as a photographer or enjoying photography or art or whatever, you know, is so important in the way that you interpret colour and what it means to you. And I think that once as a photographer you can understand your palette, then you can start articulating that in your photographs, and then you can kind of tell when that's someone's picture.
Are you proud of that photo you took
of Kate?
Yeah
I am. Yeah, I think in the context, like I said, yeah.
Is that one of your favourites you put forward, and then they choose, or can you actually say, this is the one I want, guys?
I mean, I've always been quite tight with my edits, only simply because, you know, I spend so much time in the darkroom editing and then editing down even more, and I always sort of...
So you always work on film as well?
Yeah, it's all analogue.
That's amazing, because you rarely hear people talk about the darkroom nowadays. It's always about
digital. It's had a great resurgence, if that's the word. You know, like 6 years ago-ish, it was sort of almost... I remember I had this, it's the same dark room I have now, but I had this really small dark room in a really small rental dark room. And now that dark room is now grown, and they've got two spaces.
They're
about to get another one. So it's really changed.
It's like music as well, with vinyl records and how they and Rough Trade really helped promote them in London, and how that's ended up becoming a thing again. I'm so happy for that.
But is it more of a risk that you might have corrupt film, or the work might not come out because you're not seeing it instantly? And
I mean, I've never seen it like that. It's the reason I love analog so much. It really does come down to actually that you're not seeing what you're doing, and you trust
instincts,
your gut and your instinct, because you have to.
Right.
And you learn to sort of do that. And, you know, like with the Kate pictures that I did in India, we did only shot for an hour, and I went all the way to India.
Wow.
And I was like, afterwards, I was like, and I still get it. I'm like, I go in sort of panic mode
of course.
A little bit, but it's part of it. And it's sort of funny. But in the moment, I do trust myself in the moment, because I've had to over the last sort of 10 years, because it's all on analog.
And I think that translates, though, into the images. I think all of that tension.
Yeah, I think it's mistakes is the most unbelievably brilliant thing. And I think I have nothing against digital photography, because if that's what works for you, then
do
fantastic.
You ever do it, though?
No.
No, wow.
But when I was assisting, you can see that the idea of a mistake is not allowed to happen, because you see what you're doing, and then someone might say, this shouldn't be like that, or we should move this, and then suddenly you're sort of moving away from instinct because you can see, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
So with analog photography, I think what's so fantastic about it is it gives room for mistakes and chance so much more, because you can't see what you're doing.
And actually, that word instinct is so, that's exactly what it is for me. I hadn't even thought about that, but that's what you feel in the photographs, is this kind of, it's like palpable, this kind of like, you do feel this communication between you and the person in front of you, and that it's genuine. And also, I think you don't, your work doesn't fetishize the idea of like street clothing, or even the idea that you're taking pictures without, you know, outside of the studio, without lights, without Photoshop, without all that stuff. It's not even about that somehow. It's just about trying to present something real or something. But again, not in a fetishistic way.
Yeah.
Which is still valid. And you see that in other people's work.
No,
and it's great,
sure.
Of course.
Yeah.
But I feel like with you, it's not about that. And I feel like we're looking at your photographs. I'm there with that person, particularly in that picture of Kate the other day. I was just so blown away by that picture. Even I saw it through digital, you know, on my telephone, through Instagram on a I haven't seen it printed yet.
Yeah.
But I immediately was like, that is an incredible photo. Of her. I feel like it captured her soul, and it's a really
fantastic
moment.
How does that feel for you then,
moment?
to have your work on the cover of Vogue? Is that the pinnacle of what it is to be a fashion photographer for you?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I never really think about it like that. I guess it's just what I find great about it is, again, like, you know, the sort of context of it and the history that Kate has. And, you know, I'm always very, you know, I tend to be, not selective is not the right word, but I sort of really wait for projects. So for projects that really inspire me, if it's a particular person, or if it's a fashion editorial or something like that. And, you know, the history of Kate and obviously her relevance within British culture and in the context of Vogue, it was exciting to then be to say to Edward, I want to go by myself. There shouldn't really be any hair and makeup. I don't think there should be a stylist. You know what I mean? It's sort of, that's kind of more exciting than necessarily the end product. It's more just because of the context, it's interesting.
And she was up for that.
Yeah, she seemed,
That's
seemed,
great.
She seemed well up.
Did you have a relationship with her anyway? Do you know?
No, I'd never met her.
Right.
That's interesting as well, because that's probably, it's quite good in a way when you don't know people, because I guess that creates a different kind of way of photographing somebody.
Yeah, well, I think where it may have came from her point of view in terms of her wanting to do it, was that I'd actually did a project, a cover for Italian Vogue a few years ago, and it was of Giselle, who's like this, you know, just Giselle sort of. And I did a similar thing, but I went to her home in Boston and I photographed her. I think it was at 5:30 a.m. in the morning, just as she got out of bed.
Wow.
And that was the idea. And
that was your idea?
Yeah. And I wanted.
And how much convincing did Giselle need?
She was
for that?
None. She was like well up for it.
So cool.
And it was amazing because it's quite a funny story where, you know, I turned up at a house at, I think it was, you know, it was dark. And it was me and this Kevin, who's like the art director of Italian Vogue at the time. And again, no stylist or hair and makeup. And we turned up, we knocked on the door, and I think it was her assistant answered the door. And she said, go upstairs and check her wardrobe if you want her to wear anything. And she obviously wasn't in the room. And then she opened the door and she had like this sort of grey jumper on and bunny rabbit slippers.
Oh wow.
And it was amazing. She really did look amazing. And we did the picture with the bunny rabbit slippers
so
on
good.
Down in her kitchen as the sun was coming in. And you know, and that the spirit of that is so, it's sort of and what was so amazing, once I did that project, I had so many, you know, older women of that age email me and text me saying, God, it resonated with them. And I thought, and I guess it did with Kate as well, maybe. I don't know.
And she reached out and said, like, thanks, or do you know her response to it?
Giselle, yeah, no, she said, yeah.
And what about Kate?
Yeah, no, she likes it. Yeah, we were texting and I
was you, right?
Well, no. But I sent her like a, but I've got like this old Nokia phone, so I was,
what?
Yeah.
You are so
actually,
old school.
I texted you last night and it went green instead of blue, because you know with iPhones,
well,
you,
that means someone's got a Nokia.
No, it just means that they're not on Wi-Fi or whatever. It's like a analog text message. And I was like, oh, he must not have a smartphone.
Yeah.
Are you not on Instagram?
So
I have an Instagram account, but I can't have it on my phone, on the Nokia.
Why are you on the Nokia?
It's a silly thing. It's just, I found myself.
You like Snake?
Yeah, I'm addicted to Snake. But they've updated the Snake, so it's nowhere near as good.
What?
As it was. Yeah, it's like this weird sort of bubble cartoon Snake instead of.
Fuck off!
I know, it's a shame. But it's because it's going to sound so cheesy saying it over here, but it's just because I noticed that. You don't really daydream when you have an iPhone. You know, like when you're bored or you're on the bus.
I did that yesterday.
And you're immediately on it. And I found myself just doing that all the time. And then with this Nokia, this you can't do anything with it anyway.
No. So I just like put it in your pocket or support.
Yeah, and I just find myself sort of thinking a bit more, which just sounds so silly.
It doesn't sound silly. I want to do that, but I'm addicted to my phone. I literally find myself just spiraling, like, in this vortex of checking everything, and then I'm realizing an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours,
yeah,
it's gone by, and now you've got this screen time thing that says your screen time's up by 44%.
I know,
this week. I'm like, what? You've spent 9 hours a day on your
phone. And I've gone back on Instagram since doing the podcast because we felt like I should be on it.
Well, it's work, isn't it?
But I actually love it though, and I think it's great to be connected in a way. But I know what you mean. You do miss out. I think maybe we need to like have rules where on the weekend you don't do it or something, so you can daydream again.
Yeah, and you can like. Daydream, you're right, because you do end up just daydreaming on your phone.
Yeah, it's true.
Maybe, yeah, but it's not the same, is it?
Well, no, but it is. It's that kind of like just like zoning out in a weird like trance like.
But I guess it's nice when you daydreaming without your phone. It's sort of this empty black space that you start filling with all sorts of stuff. But it's kind of
I think when I'm working more, I'm on my phone less. I'm thinking about that. But when I haven't got work, I'm literally just like,
yeah. Fills,
pictures
fills
of me
that,
and my dog.
That space, yeah. So, Jamie, yeah. I went to the Hepworth Wakefield, I think it was a few years ago.
Sorry, I'm trying to pour tea.
Russell's just like throwing teacups.
I'm angry
He's like,
about that.
Hepworth Wakefield?
What?
Throw it around
you
the room.
There?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a 4-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a 4-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser's also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
I went there a few years ago, and J.W. Anderson had curated a show called Disobedient Bodies. J.W. Anderson had curated a show called Disobedient Bodies.
That's the one.
And you were included in it in a few different ways, but one of the most interesting was a project that you did photographing local kids, is that right?
Yeah, from Wakefield.
Yeah, and that follows on, I guess, from the Preston book in a way, because yeah. They were like, they're not real models, but they're...
Exactly, yeah.
And explain that whole project.
Well, I actually did a... So after the bus station, I started, you know, I started assisting, and then I started to do fashion. And one of the first stylists that I worked with was this guy, Benjamin Bruno, a French stylist.
Cool.
And we did a project up in Newcastle where we took a bag of clothes and photographed kids as we came across them on the street and dressed them there and then.
What sort of clothes?
One of the pictures that stands out is this. We photographed this girl in a huge blue Calvin Klein suit.
Oh, wow, like so proper fashion clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
Couture stuff.
I was about to say, it sounds like Diane Arbus.
That wasn't couture, but it was pretty close visually, if you can.
Wow.
And then we had like this huge sort of tinsel jumper that we photographed on this kid skateboarding. And it's an extremely simple approach, but it really did work. And it was for Man About Town at the time.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
But
these are clothes that they can just chuck on than having to go behind
it. The girl that had the blue Calvin, yeah. I wish I could show you a script. I wish I could show you.
We'll post it on our talk art Instagram.
It's just a pinnacle. It really, for me, is such a sort of pinnacle moment, because I'd been so used to photographing kids as they were, or teenagers as they were. And then suddenly the idea of then elevating their character or changing their character then opened up fashion
to high art,
it was
yeah.
like, wow, you know, you can really, the sense of play is amazing. So we found this kid, we asked her parents if she had like this flowery dress on. We were like, can we put this big bulky blue suit on? And she just, her character changed like that, and it really is an incredible moment. And anyway, so we were doing that together, and then Benjamin started working for Jonathan. So then that's where that relationship came from.
Right.
So then if we fast forward to the Wakefield kids, it was sort of an extension of that idea, where we had all these amazing archive clothes and we wanted to include kids from Wakefield. So I think 140 of them came
over
3 hours in Wakefield. So I got like this little window inside the museum, and I photographed, and it was amazing because it was so quick. And I really love it when I've sort of, sometimes I'm in two, when I'm taking pictures, I kind of go in two modes, where if I put my camera on a tripod, it kind of slows life down and becomes very much about composition and color. And then I actually did start using this other camera, which was a Pentax, and you can be a lot more free, and I tend to shoot black and white, and you can be very, and it sort of speeds up life. It's very hard to explain, but yeah, so I did the Wakefield like that.
How did you find the kids? Was it just like an email round robin type thing?
Yeah, we did like this huge open casting where we got schools involved, and obviously because it was the Hetworth and that's like an institution like that, then everybody kind of said yes. Yeah.
So how many pictures were there in the end? Because didn't you pin them all up to the wall?
Yeah, there was, there must have been about 50 prints. And then we made like a little zine where it was like all
the
kids.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the other part of that exhibition, so he was kind of almost... not revealing, but kind of celebrating, I guess, his influences and things that he looked at.
This is J.W. Anderson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So his kind of, like, even furniture,
yeah.
you know, artists like Louise Bourgeois or Sarah Lucas, like, yeah. And then you suddenly saw it in his his world as well, like in his clothes and his, the way he designed, but particularly in the way that he presented his advertising, which you shot a lot of.
Yeah.
So you also had an installation of those photographs, didn't you?
Yeah, we had those, and then we also did some new ones where we kind of played around with some of the collection on models, and then we had that in the magazine as well.
Right, right.
Because we'd started working together like that for... that was also for Man About Town, and it was just like playing with... you know, we did a whole project on cotton, and we... we dressed all these guys completely covered head to toe in. You'll have to see the pictures.
But no, I've seen them.
It was a fun exercise. And that's the joy of, you know, I hate to say it, but it sounds a bit cheesy, but the joy of fashion is that you could just be like, okay, I want to dress someone head to toe in cotton and take their picture.
Right.
You know, and there's not that many opportunities or contexts where that might necessarily kind of work or resonate with people.
Not a regular Joe couldn't do that because they wouldn't be allowed, but I guess because of who you are, you're allowed to do that. They're like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, it's sort of fun when you think of it like that.
And some of the photos had this real sense of sculpture in the physical shape, so the body was sort of changing shape almost.
Yeah,
and it reminded me of like Hepworth, and you kind of really felt these.
Yeah, I thought it
references.
I actually kind of liked the idea of, you know. Because sometimes I think at the best of times with references, you sort of, you don't hide away from them, but they're not necessarily as clear.
Right.
And it was nice to be quite literal, you know, in the idea that you were like, you know, Jonathan loves sculpture and it's in the show, so we're going to play with that with his photographs. And it actually worked.
It did work. And they became their own things again. Probably a lot to do with the lighting as well. There was a really intense kind of energy in those images.
I think as a photographer, again, you sort of, your sensibility is sort of built up over time, and you sort of, when you're in an unfamiliar situation, like, okay, we've got all these clothes, we're playing with sculpture, you sort of tap into, you know, the chance nature of people and all that, and then you sort of inject that into what you're doing, and then you still have that feeling. It sort of transcends the clearness of a reference or whatever it may be. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And the early campaign you did with him when he first took over Loewe, where you had the kind of two male figures together with long scarves and outside in coastal
locations. It was
locations.
In Spain.
Was it in Spain?
It was,
Well, I guess that makes sense because it's all made in Spain, the leather, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I love that idea of like the twin or like the double or in those shoots. And I just found that so forward thinking at the time.
Well,
it was very fresh.
Like a doppelganger thing, was it?
Kind of, yeah.
Me and Benjamin, who was the stylist, we were doing these stories for Man About Town. And I was just basically, I used to stroll through this website called Star Now, which is where people sign up if they want to be in photography shoots, if they want to make tea on set.
No.
And there's millions of faces, millions.
So good.
So because I'd spent so much time street casting and doing my own thing on the street, I thought, well, I want to inject that kind of roundedness into the fashion shoots. And that's where we started finding these kids. And I found this really tall guy who had an amazing face, and then a really short guy who had this incredible face. So we're like, right, plonk them together. And, it, you know, something so simple and naive as that, but it kind of just worked. So then we basically transferred that idea over to Loewe, because you're building, you know, with fashion, I think at the best of times you're kind of building a language. So Jonathan wanted that over in Loewe, so we just kind of transferred it over.
Are you allowed to use these images if you wanted to do a show like a retrospective of your work? Are you allowed to use fashion images that a brand has bought?
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
they still belong. They're still your copyright, aren't they? Because
I've done quite a few shows where I've kind of mixed the fashion in with work that I've done elsewhere. And I've always struggled with the idea of, you know, personal work and documentary or fashion, because, you know, if you really believe in the projects, then it all just feeds into one thing, you know, one way of seeing.
Mm. Yes.
And I've always really believed that, you know, two boys standing on a beach, I wouldn't treat any differently to a kid in the bus station or a plant in California or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I think that's so important that kind of that feeds through and is visible.
And is it exciting for you, for example, with the Preston images? You eventually much later exhibited them in Amsterdam at the Huy Marseille, like a museum kind of public space. So how was that like doing that installation? And didn't you also show a lot of landscape photography in that?
Yeah, show? So Huy Marseille was it's a photography museum in Amsterdam, and it was this incredible space where they basically knocked the walls through two Dutch houses. So you had this incredible, there was 14 rooms, and the museum gave me every single room. And it was this idea that each room was a different place that I'd been. And it was like this idea that you would just, it's kind of like a journey, you know, you'd go through, I think the first room was Kashmir, and you'd go through there, and then the Congo, and then, Rio.
Wow, that must have felt so exciting.
There was Antarctica in the roof. So it was this incredible idea that you can kind of, I also did a project on my girlfriend at the time, and then I did the Preston bus station, and then I did this nude shoot on a beach with Joe McKenna, who made these like little bonnet hats. So it was just this idea that you can go through all these extremes and all these different places, but it very much feel like one person's point of view and one person's sensibility over all these strings.
And there were so many different textures and colours and intensities of like personality from the location as well.
Yeah.
But it was very much your
What was remarkable about that was Preston. So basically what I did with the Preston installation was that we'd found like a corridor and some steps, and I basically just did a huge circle like I did when I was...
Oh, cool.
Which is very simple, but then the room next to that was Antarctica, which I did for... I do a lot of documentary work, and I did...
Oh, you still do that then, the documentary?
Oh, yeah. It's actually more... I actually do that way more.
Oh,
you know,
right.
Like the fashion's almost sort of like 5%. It's kind of funny. And
it's
I was
funny
talking
because
about,
it gets seen so about, much, yeah. doesn't it?
Because I was going to ask, did your career change if you'd
I was talking
you'd
about
experience a documentary photographer? But.
No, yeah, it's kind of what I do a lot of. But so Antarctica, yeah, so you leave Preston bus station and you come into Antarctica. And I remember at the time when I did the documentary project for Antarctica, which was for Wall Street Journal, I couldn't be any further away from Preston bus station in my mind in every way, because I basically come
same through... temperature though, isn't it?
Yeah, fucking is. Do you know what the bus station was like? A bloody ice box.
I bet it was.
You needed one of those thick Loewe wool scarves.
Yeah,
which you want, right?
Which I want, which I don't
which
have.
You're saying.
I never got one. I love them.
I'll get you one.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a really nice Loewe bag. I remember.
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah,
so glamorous.
Yeah, Jonathan gave me that.
Yeah,
do you still use it?
No, it's in my.
It's past season now, isn't it?
It's not even that. It's like an artwork. It's so beautiful.
It is a fantastic.
Yeah,
bag.
I remember coming to your studio at your house.
Yeah.
In East London, and just the first thing I said was like, "I love that bag." And
more, you were like, more
weirdo.
Than the work. More than the work. It's the
weirdo.
Bag.
That's what we talked about. Was the bag.
Yeah. Actually, talking about your house, so you have such impeccable taste as well. And I remember going into your kitchen, and it was all just like so perfect. I was like, "This is like the perfect kitchen." Like all the different textures and the marble surfaces, but it was done in a really unusual way. It wasn't like your typical, you know, fit out. It was a very, it felt like you'd chosen every single piece and put it all
together.
Well,
that marble was like this weird Irish, that Cecilia, who helps me out sometimes, she's from Ireland, and she knew of this guy who basically had all this marble left over in his, it wasn't expensive, it was like this, but the colour was like sick.
So good.
Which sounds really weird, but it was like, it had like...
Oh, not sick as in cool.
Like, no,
sick
like
as in sick, right. Literally sick.
Right.
And it had like pink streaks through it and all this kind of weird stuff. So yeah,
and also you had that amazing textile work in a big
frame. Oh, Milton Avery.
Milton Avery.
Yeah.
Oh,
who
what?
Russell
you got
loved.
Milton Avery.
So I wanted to bring that up.
It was my girlfriend actually at the time. She got it for me, and it's one of my favorite painters is Milton Avery.
Yeah.
And at one point he made these big tapestries, which are sent. Yeah, these tapestries. And to my surprise at the time, my girlfriend sort of gave me a little piece of paper, and it was the size of like a stamp on the paper, and she was like, "I got you this," and I was like, "Oh wow." And then she was like, "Oh, but it's a tapestry that's going to arrive in a couple of weeks," and it was huge.
So amazing.
It's incredible.
Wow.
And you'd just been teaching me about him at the time, Russ.
Yeah, that's right.
And I
did a show at the Met in
exactly.
Yeah.
And that, and I said to you, I was like, "I've just
he's so incredible,
him.
So incredible,
so incredible."
Yeah.
Is it Victoria Miro showing?
Yeah, no, it was.
Oh, it was.
Oh, it had the show.
I had a show. Yeah, okay,
and it was a good. It was a great show, actually.
Wow, that's amazing you live with that.
Yeah.
It's really great. And I loved it when you opened all those photography boxes and you were like going through all these different images that I'd never even seen. A lot of the photo documentary rather than, you know, portraits. And I'd never seen all that part of your work. And
it's funny because I was literally talking about it to someone the other day, and I've been doing these sort of independent shows and stuff just to try and not to get people to know that work, because it's, you know, I enjoy doing it and that should be enough, but I'm just trying to kind of open up that work a lot.
Yeah, and like different audiences as well.
Yeah, and also, you know, in the context of a gallery and you're trying to work within a space, you know, as you know, it's sort of then you have to articulate something in a slightly different way and work with the space that you have. And that's been such an interesting thing to do as well. And, you know, I'm trying to think how long it was now. About a year and a half ago, I started spending a lot of time up in Inverness in Scotland, and I just found myself making these little sculptures, and I had a show of all these little sculpture things. And it wasn't that I was consciously trying to be like, "Oh, I'm going to start making sculpture," but it was another nice way of just the chance nature of things, you know, that I was in this place and I started making these things, and then I thought,
what were you making them for?
So they were all just found objects on this place where I was staying in Inverness, which is in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I started just making these, all these little assemblies. And then in the show, they
were like welding them or gluing.
No, they're all balanced. So in the show, as part of the show, I would walk around and reassemble them if they fell apart. So that was part of the show.
And that's like a chance
again. Yeah, and it's just it's been so fascinating. I've done, you know, a lot of things over the last couple of years where it's just building on, sounds sort of simple to say, but just the chance nature of things.
How do you archive your work? So if you work on film,
yeah,
you obviously have the negatives.
Yeah.
But does your work ever get transferred to digital or an archive somewhere in case?
So I print all of my work anyway, so there's always a hard copy like that.
How many
like
do you print?
Like a 12 by 16.
But would you do like an edition of that and APs if you were ever going to release them, or would they?
Yeah, I've been trying. It's funny with that because I've had sort of people wanting to buy photographs and I've never really known.
Oh yeah, we spoke about that a bit.
Yeah, I've never really known what to do.
Yeah.
But I make prints anyway for myself in terms of...
Do you have a lot of galleries? Like a...
I've been sort of trying to kind of bridge that gap, I suppose, and seek that out. But it's sort of, it's a difficult one.
Yeah.
But
I think it will just come though in time. Because I think the more people get to understand that you aren't necessarily... Because it's funny when Ross said to you, I actually loved this response you gave earlier, but when he said, is it amazing getting on the front cover of Vogue? And you were like, well, kind of, but I'm not really that... You know, it's like, yes, you're happy to do it, but it wasn't like you ever wanted to be a fashion photographer. Well, and I don't feel like you have one of those fashion ego things, which can be amazing, though, and entertaining and brilliant and a way of, you know, inspiring people.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like that's who you are, which is probably why I also connected with you more than I would to a flashy kind of,
Hollywood. It's not so much about the wanting to be on the cover of Vogue. It's just make the context of it make sense.
Yes.
And I think that's always the most important. You know, I've done projects where it's two pages or one page, but it makes sense, and that's why I want to do it. And you know what I mean? It's never...
Where are you from?
Ipswich.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, where are you from?
Essex.
Ah, cool.
So sort of,
and I'm from Berkshire.
Yeah, we're not asking you.
Yeah. Well, I'm just...
You're the posh one in the corner.
Yeah.
I am not... Okay.
you had a nickname at school, which I really like.
Big ears.
Yeah. I had that as well.
Did you?
Yeah.
I hate...
Well, look at my ears. But the thing is, my ears aren't big. They're big. Little, but they just stick out.
Well, my ears were the same now as they were when I was younger.
So have a look at your ears.
Behind so imagine...
At the minute.
They can't be totally the same.
You've got nice ears.
I thought they grow, don't they?
But my head's obviously...
So you had a pea-head with them ears.
Exactly.
Right.
And that didn't go down very well for years. Yeah, and it wasn't just a nickname. It's sort of... I used to get beaten up for it. It's weird.
What?
Kids are so strange.
I got called like Wingnut, Cup, Car Doors.
Wow.
All of those things.
I just had big ears.
I just got called Oscar a lot because the bullies I had were really intelligent and they thought I was gay, which I obviously was. And they used to cough at me and go, Oscar, because Oscar Wilde was gay.
Yeah.
And I used to say to them, well done, you've done your gay history. I would like talk back to them. I was so like whatever about
strange,
it. I just didn't care. I was just like, if you're going to bully me, I'm just going to talk back at you because screw you. And I think it's character building, isn't it?
Definitely it is.
So recently, talking about your fashion work, recently you shot for a label that I was obsessed with when I was growing up called Marnie.
Yeah.
And recently...
Oh, he's obsessed with Marnie, God.
Consuelo Castiglione, the original founder of Marnie, was one of my heroes. And then when she left and sold the business, there's a new designer who you've been working with recently.
Yeah.
Who
Francesco
Rizzo.
Yeah.
And he has actually taken the brand to a really interesting place, I think.
Yeah.
Initially, I was really scared because I was so used to her language. But
you weren't a fan to begin with.
No, I wasn't a fan, actually. And I was terrified because I was like, what's happening? Where's my Consuelo gone? Where's, you know, what's happening?
He was genuinely distraught.
But I'm actually wearing a T-shirt today.
This is not new,
but it's like a year
it's past
ago.
Past season.
Old Marnie.
Vintage
Marnie. But it is Francesco Rizzo. But it's covered in boats because I thought it would signify our meeting. And
the breeze, because you need a breeze to get the boats to go.
Exactly. Our form
and they're all moving. On there,
they are
they're
all
they're
moving.
Going they, somewhere.
They're
they
in
are
a
going
wind,
somewhere, just
up,
like
yeah.
us. We're all going somewhere. But how was it to work with him? Because those photographs were really artistic. I mean, really stunning photos.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, like you say, he's sort of he's now, I guess, he's got in his stride, so to speak.
Yes,
with
exactly.
I guess you notice that when someone gets into their rhythm as a designer.
It's great to see, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so they asked me to do the campaign, and I loved the collection. I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And we actually did I went to a town called Almo to photograph. This was a few years ago, to photograph Michael Heinzer.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this land art. You know Michael Heinzer?
I don't.
He is like the land artist.
Oh right.
Yeah, he's kind of 80 now.
Oh cool.
And he's sort of part of the whole kind of...
I live
like,
on the same street, I think, as Richard Long.
Long, yes.
So I always think of Richard
Long.
But...
Yeah. He's kind of he's sort of a generate. If you sort of mentioned Michael Heinzer to Richard Long, he'd probably be like,
I probably should know him, but
so
that's
he's
what
older
I love about
than Richard
art.
Long. He's
yeah.
All right.
He's incredible. Anyway, he's for the last sort of like I guess 40 years he's been making this piece of art called The City, which no one's ever been to. And the New Yorker asked me to go and take his portrait and do a portrait of the city.
Oh wow!
In the Nevada desert, and it's kind of a crazy story where I was staying in this place called the Cowboys Inn. And I've got a T-shirt saying "The Cowboy's Dream,"
which is
it's an amazing T-shirt which I got from that inn. Anyway, so it's this inn that's kind of in the middle of nowhere. You stay there, and then you make the drive to this place called the City. And again, he's extremely protective over it because he doesn't want anyone seeing it, or he does, but in a very particular way.
Right.
And I got there, and it's a long story, but it's kind of they didn't really like me at first, and they kind of took my cameras and took me into a room because basically I'd missed an email saying that someone was going to come pick me up, and I made my own way there.
Oh.
And they thought that I was someone I wasn't, so they took my camera, took everything, and I'd sit in this little room.
Wow.
For like, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours, but then it was all fine, and they were he was really lovely, and it was all great.
Wow.
But it was just that little moment, and then I had this fantastic moment where I had this little buggy. I mean, it's hard for you guys to visualize because his work's astounding, and I had this little buggy, and I was driving to get the sunrise across this amazing sculpture.
Wow.
There is a point to this story. So anyway, so I did that, and then I was staying in this little inn that was in this town called Elmo, and I spent lots of time taking portraits of people there. And the collection before this one that I just did, we took the collection to this town in Elmo and dressed everyone in Elmo in Marnie.
Oh.
Well, yeah, which was kind of fantastic. Again, and everyone got paid, and it was like this really great...
So that's why it feels so different though, because it does feel like new somehow, those
pictures.
And, I love them.
And so we did that, and then which was great. And then this collection... which is maybe it's the one you're talking of. It's like a girl in a she's like kind of
yes.
The collection was so strong that it didn't need it, you could just have someone standing in it and it'd be really incredible. So I found this really amazing in France. I forgot the sculptor, but there's a museum, and we asked if we could use this sculpture room because I went there and I could see that the light was incredible.
I know, it's amazing.
So what was amazing about that, it was that, so it's a north-facing light, but what someone must have done years later near this sculpture studio was build a huge white building. So the sun was hitting this white building, and then it was like, bringing in all of this incredibly
architecturally, they did that. They knew.
No.
Oh.
So this was years later. So the sculpture was the sculpt, and then she passed away. And then they opened the museum, and then someone would have then built across the road or whatever this huge white building. And just by chance, the sun hits that. And because the room's north facing, you then get all this. It's mental, the light. It was truly amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's.
And if you're listening, you can actually see a lot of these images on Francesco Rizzo's own Instagram. He's got a hilarious Instagram, which I really find very entertaining, called A Slice of Bambi. And yeah, it kind of sums up his very unusual take on the world.
Can you access that on a Nokia?
No, you can't.
Oh, okay.
But you can share your friends' ones. If your friends are Russ and Rob, they both have smartphones.
So yeah. You must be a light fanatic. I mean, you must go out in the street and be like, wow, if I could find someone in this light, it'd be really exciting.
Yeah, if I do see, you know, I don't do it all the time, but if I see, if I am walking along and there's a nice drop. Weirdly, when you're in, it tends to be when you're in big cities and the light hits the glass of like a business building, you'll get this sort of funny, you know, I think, what's his name, used it quite a lot. Philip Lorca de Corso, maybe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Honestly, when he did the street ones.
Yeah, but actually, I think he might have lit that.
You love natural light. I mean, you would work with natural light all the time.
Yeah.
But I think as a photographer, you do have that where when you're walking out in the world, you sort of could see the potential for something.
Yeah,
I was hanging out last year with Tim Walker a bit, and we went on a walk in Hampstead Heath once, and he saw a rolling hill there and was like, oh my God, the light today is amazing. We could do a shoot because his is very romantic, over the top kind of.
He's great, Tim.
Yeah.
Do you do self-portraits?
I've done two
in
my flat.
Really?
Yeah.
What are they like?
I was messing around with... So when I moved into the flat that you'd been to, I had one room where it was like a kind of... I don't know, like a study room, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's one spare bedroom. And I was using it to kind of mess around with like sculpture and drawing and just messing around and experimenting. And I had like this massive block of, what's the sort of wet stuff?
Clay.
Clay, that's it.
Wet stuff, I love that.
So I was messing around with that, and then I thought,
there'd been something else in your apartment. Yeah. A massive block of it. What?
Yeah, so I was sort of messing around with that, and I thought, oh, I'll just take some self-portraits of me kind of messing around with it. So I've sort of got these funny Polaroids of me messing around with clay.
Wow, I want to see those.
Yeah, so I don't know if you do. They're not very... They're
we
not
ask
very...
every guest who comes on the show, if you could do an imaginary art heist and steal any artwork or anything from a museum anywhere, what would you take home?
Do you know what? I recently got this book called Fertile Image by Paul Nash. Paul Nash, yeah, the painter. Yeah, yeah. So he, before he died, he was sort of painting from all of these photographs that he'd taken over time.
Mm.
And his wife made a book called Fertile Image with all of these pictures. And they're really amazing. They're very sort of, they cross between being very objective of like stones to then sort of like pieces of wood or dead trees or... you know, corner of a boat or some sky, and they're really amazing. And I think maybe if I went into a museum and saw one of those little black and white photographs, I'd be like, yoink,
dong,
ding, ding, ding,
yeah,
good
up,
one.
And then up on my wall, probably.
Cool.
Who are your photography heroes?
That's a good question. I really like this guy William Christenberry.
Okay,
he's sort of a contemporary of William Eccleston.
Hmm.
Who's got a show coming up here?
Oh, has he?
Yeah, Zverna's got one.
Ah,
Eggleston,
cool.
Yeah?
Yeah, 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 Eggleston, yeah.
Yeah.
I've always been I am a huge fan of William Eggleston.
Me too.
But this guy, William Christenberry, he kind of went under the radar a little bit. And he's incredible because he basically spent like 20 years going to this same barn, it's green, and photographing it over 20 years. And then what he'll do
the
is...
The same setup.
The same setup, yeah. And you'll just see the slight decay over the years. But you have to see the pictures for it to resonate. But and then he'd make sculptures of these barns and then paintings as well. And so you'd really have this like amazing kind of 360 degree of a man's mind working through...
It's obsessive.
Yeah, and it was so... And he's so brilliant. And I have one of his little green barn pictures in my flat.
Wow.
Cool.
And he's always been a kind of guy that I've really, and as well William Eccleston as well. I was really lucky enough. The New York Times asked me to do a speech about him to him at this celebratory dinner.
The Met last year.
Yeah, no, not last year. It was the New York Times greats. They do like this issue once every, maybe once a year, maybe. But then they have a dinner, and he was part of.
You've got a good relationship with him because the Style magazine you worked for a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And at the time, who the editor was, she asked me to. Deborah asked me to do the speech, and I sat with his like this on a table with his whole family. Mm. He was sitting there, and I stood up and did a speech about his photography.
Yeah,
so that's all
at dinner as well.
Yeah,
it's very quiet.
Oh, he's very quiet.
He talked.
I talked more to his daughter and his son.
Yes,
than him. But it was an incredible moment for me because
it's a hero.
It's funny when you're at university. I think when you look at a lot of photography. Obviously, your taste changes a lot, and so there's some, photo books that I look at now and go, God, I can't believe I like that. But William Eccleston is the type of guy where you're brand new to photography, and you can access it,
yeah.
Yeah, and then also 20 years after you've been doing it forever, you can still resonates.
More.
Yeah, so it's sort of that was a kind of great moment for me.
Wow.
And there's a guy, Jem Southern, that I really like, who did this amazing project called Red River, where he followed this river around Cornwall. And the pictures are kind of all 10:8, and they're kind of amazing. And
I can see this land art like influence,
yeah.
Like that you want your land art interest. You're saying about Heisner pictures, and then you're saying about the Green Barn, you're saying about this Red River. It's like,
well, it all
you
just
like nature.
It just kind of just feed. It's all sort of
it's the natural world, and what the photographs you're taking are of people in their natural habitat. It's like you want
to. I know there's a real soul to it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, it's funny you were saying earlier about
poetic
about plants and stuff. I just started to make this little book. Is this Japanese company called the Gold Collection? Gold Collection, and they do these incredible books. And I'm going to do one with them on plants, trees, and flowers.
Because
I've been to so many places. Like even in Antarctica, there's this one picture I took of these two Arctic terns, and they're mating on this rock.
Hot.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty hot. and then below them is all these incredible flowers growing on this rock.
Oh.
And it's like there's also another one where when I did this project in the Congo, and I had such an idea, again a documentary project, and I had such an idea of what I thought the Congo would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to take this boat journey, and I was on this boat, and I'd actually fallen asleep on the boat. And I woke up and I looked outside and it was the most amazing landscape I've ever seen. And I ran out and I photographed this one small tree in this huge landscape. Mm. Yeah, again, you have to see the picture.
Wow.
And actually, the Huis Marseille show was called Landscape with a Tree.
Yes.
Because it was all about this idea that you have in your mind what you think something's going to be. And it's something as simple as a landscape and a tree. But then, you know, once you actually see it, it's like, it's so different to what I expected.
Wow.
And funnily enough, what was quite funny about that was a guy came to the show. He didn't know my work. He just knew Huis Marseille. And then afterwards, he went to reception and said, "I'd like to complain. There's only one landscape with a tree in this show."
Oh, brilliant.
And it was you know what I mean? It's like absolutely brilliant that that's happened. But anyway, yeah.
That's
so
fantastic.
I don't know what my point was, but...
Well, our final question for you, we're going to tie up the interview now, is what is your favourite colour?
Oh,
it's a tough one, isn't it?
Today it's probably green.
So it changes.
Yeah, I think so.
What other days?
Explain why today green.
Yeah. Because we're just talking about that tree.
The green barn as well, right?
Yeah, and the green barn. Yeah. But the tree, I remember, it's just so green, that picture. Mm. It's making me think about green.
So again, if we hadn't had that conversation, what colour would you have said?
Blue, maybe.
Okay, interesting. So you're swayed by conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You have lots of colours.
Yeah, I've got one more question that I've always wanted to ask. I wanted to ask. What is the sexiest camera that you could ever have?
The sexiest camera. Probably.
Or like the brand.
So this the camera that I have.
Oh yeah.
it's an RB67, and basically there's no batteries. There's no batteries, so it's all mechanical.
Wow.
And if you take off the lens and you take off the back of the camera, it is literally a box. It's a box. And I think that's pretty fucking sexy when it comes to cameras, that it's just so, and you can just see through it. It's literally a box. I'll have to show you both.
But you have to wind it up. How did you do it?
Yeah, so it has this on the, once you take a picture, there's a big thing on the side where you cock it, and that cocks the mirror, but it's all mechanical.
Wow.
And I always just, it's such a great camera because it's so simple like that. It sort of, in a sexy way, opens up your mind because it's so simple. It's just a box. And the idea, like, you can put someone in front of a box and take their portrait.
Yeah,
is that's
kind
amazing.
Of, it's kind of amazing. Yeah, and like I say, it needs no battery. So, I guess,
so cool.
Wow.
Yeah,
and also you love simplicity, like Nokia phones.
Exactly.
So
I'm going to finish in a quote that you said, that you're successful if you like your own work. Do you stand by that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I can't remember.
Success for you is.
Yeah, I think because the woman at the time was talking about, you know, if you do lots of work for magazines and stuff like that, and you must feel like a success. But I think, you know, you could just be taking pictures of stones your whole life. But if that's what you really love, you know, I don't think success is geared towards doing, you know, commercial work or editorial. And if you're happy with your photographs, then that's
enough.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Good advice.
Well, we love them.
Yeah,
we
thank you so
you come
much.
On,
thanks so much.
Thank
no
you.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And
for
everyone listening, please go out and try and buy Preston Bus Station, the book published by Dashwood by Jamie Hawksworth, because it's a really incredible book.
And then look at our talk art for all images. We're going to be putting a lot of these images up because we reference them a lot, and we want you to enjoy that experience as we're going through this.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Thank
we'll be
very
back
much.
Very soon.
Big love. Thanks,
Jamie.
Bye.
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 You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.